From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, gearing up for tomorrow's ruling from Judge Rhodes in the Detroit bankruptcy trial.
There's not a lot of mystery here. I mean, you talk to people who understand the process, and I think everybody expects that he will, in fact, confirm the plan.
Plus, bringing little free libraries to the city of Detroit. Take a book, leave a book.
A place where people can talk and share stories not only about the stories they're reading, but also the stories of their lives.
And we'll talk football. It's MSU against Ohio State this weekend.
It will be a slugfest, and whoever wins that game, almost everyone believes, me included, will win the Big Ten and get a real shot at one of the four playoff spots in January.
Those stories and much more today for you on Stateside. Millions and millions of dollars were spent in Michigan leading up to Election Day. But when you look at the results, not much has changed. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today on Stateside, how much money was spent on this election? And then we talk football with John U. Bacon.
I'm used now to getting sympathy from Buckeye fans about the Wolverines. Now the Spartans are starting to feel bad, pity even, for the Wolverines. And that's something that I've not experienced in my lifetime.
But first, the wait will soon be over for a verdict in Detroit's historic bankruptcy case. Detroit News business columnist Daniel Howes is here now to bring us up to date. Daniel, it was a couple of weeks ago bankruptcy judge Stephen Rhodes indicated he would hand down his ruling this week. What's the latest?
Here's where we're at. It was originally scheduled for 2 o'clock on Friday, and he's moved it up to 1 o'clock on Friday to give some of us ink-stained wretches a little more time, I suppose, to make deadline. But I think there's not a lot of mystery here. I mean, you talk to people who understand the process, and I think everybody expects that he will, in fact, confirm the plan and begin the process for Detroit to emerge from bankruptcy. When he issues that oral ruling, that would not be the point at which they officially emerge, but he will go through his reasoning, probably like he did in December of 2013, when he ruled that Detroit was eligible for bankruptcy. And then subsequent to that, he'll file a written opinion recapitulating some of the points that he made. And that begins a process of some hearings and some other things to officially mark the exit. But, you know, really we're going to be moving into a different phase. Kevin Orr, the emergency manager, it was in his office a couple of weeks ago, and literally he picked up a file. It was about 4 inches thick, and he said, "Hook shot," and it went into a big bin in his office. So, the people that have been involved in this are cleaning up, cleaning out, and getting ready to move on to other things.
And then what? Because that's, as you say, we're moving into a new phase. So we would say farewell to Kevin Orr. Judge Rhodes can enter his retirement, which he postponed in order to take this case on.
Technically senior status, I think, is what they call it.
Ah, okay.
I think the light really shines now in City Hall as a practical matter. Mayor Mike Duggan and City Council are going to be entrusted with and expected to execute a restructuring that was designed by other people, chiefly Kevin Orr and some of the restructuring experts that he worked with the last 18 months or so. And I think what you're going to see, I would expect, is that the judge is going to be pretty direct about his expectations of what they need to do, when they need to do it. There will be some state oversight through a financial advisory oversight board. I think the bottom line is, and the mayor has already said, that if we do our job, state involvement will be minimal. And I think he's probably right. And I would guess that if you ask the governor or some of his close staff members about that, they would say the sooner that Mayor Duggan moves ahead with this, the better. They do not want to be involved in the day-to-day management of the city, despite what some people think. It is not something they want to do, and they've got other things to deal with.
What is the verdict from bankruptcy experts on the outside who've been watching all of this in terms of how quickly and efficiently are they saying Judge Rhodes handled this trial?
Well, I think he's clearly defied a lot of expectations, that's for sure, and has done some things, and the whole trial and the state has done some things, and Kevin Orr has done some things that nobody thought could be done. Two things that come to mind. One is that Rick Snyder was going to be responsible for kicking the underpinnings of Michigan's economy out from under it by essentially having Kevin Orr stiff the bond market. In fact, it never happened, and Michigan cities and municipalities have been able to borrow money at competitive rates, despite the predictions that they wouldn't be able to. Even Detroit has been able to, and its water department has been able to issue new bonds at competitive rates. I think all the whining that they heard from the financial markets and the municipal finance markets have proven to be pretty much a lot of hot air. So, and the second point I would make is, in doing some work that I'm doing right now, I've come across a quote from a guy who's talked about mediation in Detroit. And he said, mediation in Detroit, that sounds like a lot of wasted resources to me. Well, fast forward 16 or 18 months, and the mediation in Detroit is what gave us everything from the grand bargain to getting to a solution without a single major cram down of a creditor. That's mediation, and that was what they tried to do from the beginning, and that's what Judge Rhodes had in mind, and they have been able to execute it through the leadership of Judge Jerry Rosen.
Daniel, thanks so much.
My pleasure.
Daniel House is the Detroit News business columnist. Well, it's been quite a few days for the Wolverines. Dave Brandon is now the former athletic director at the University of Michigan. Retired Steelcase executive Jim Hackett is the interim AD, and the search is on for Brandon's replacement. Michigan Radio sports commentator John U. Bacon is here. John, we keep hearing that phrase, Michigan man. Well, Dave Brandon played for Bo. He seemed to fit that template of Michigan man. Is it time to rethink what that phrase means, or maybe can it altogether?
Well, it's been out there for a long time, of course, way back to Fielding Yost. But the last 10 years, that phrase has gotten, I think, redefined many times. Now, some people say it's cliche, of course, and passe. I'm not so sure about that, but I do think that it's not the only reason why you hire anybody for anything, be it AD or coach. Don't forget, the three greatest coaches in Michigan football history are Fielding Yost, Fritz Kreisler, Bo Schembechler. Not one of them had ever gone to Michigan or played at Michigan. So you can become, I believe, a Michigan man.
What do you think this next AD needs to bring to the table?
Good question. The first question is it going to be Jimmy Hackett staying on as the AD, or is he going to hire somebody else? And that's a good question in itself. I would say, obviously, you need business acumen. You need to know how Michigan works. It's obviously a complicated place. But you better understand coaches. When I was talking to Don Canham, the legendary AD at Michigan, a number of times over the years, he said to me that everyone says it's more important to have business background than athletic background. And he said, I fundamentally reject this. And he was a millionaire businessman also. And he said, look, you can always hire an accountant. You can hire a CFO. You can hire a lawyer. You have to anyway. He said, you can't be taught how to handle coaches. And if you don't handle coaches well, if you don't know what those poor guys are going through, men and women, all right, you can never lead them properly and give them what they need to succeed. And if they don't succeed, marketing and accountants and lawyers will not save you.
And we've just seen that drama play out.
True enough.
There we go.
Turns out Don Canham, guess what, was right.
He was right. We've seen names get kicked around. I know, like, the day after, the Detroit Free Press was, you know, offering up possible athletic director candidates, Ward Manuel and Brad Bates. They even threw in the name of Diane Dietz, which I thought was intriguing as kind of a, you know, a long shot, but an interesting discussion as a wild card with a different background and view of the landscape. It certainly got a legendary place in Michigan athletics.
Absolutely. I saw her on Saturday, as a matter of fact. She is doing a great job for the Big Ten, as you well know, in communications. Sharp as can be, played basketball at Michigan, one of the pioneers, and a very good basketball player, and just a very impressive person.
I think her record's still standing from the 80s.
Which is incredible.
Yeah.
The game has changed. You got three-pointers now and all the rest, and her records still hold, which is quite something. She would be, I can see that name on that list, and that makes sense to me. Right now, trust me when I tell you, the old line from William Goldman, the Hollywood producer, nobody knows anything. That I don't think even right now Jim Hackett knows what the time frame is on his tenure as interim, who the candidates might be, let alone what they're going to do with football in case Brady Hoke does not, in fact, right the ship, which is obviously a very pressing issue.
Who do you think should be on the list?
The name's there. I've been saying that for weeks, so nothing new on that list right there. Brad Bates is probably the most obvious one. That is the guy that Bo said in his book that I wrote with Bo back in 07. That's the guy who should be the next AD. He thought Brandon should be the next governor. So maybe Bo was right again about that. So Brad Bates on the short list there. Ward Manuel played for Bo also, now the AD at UConn. Jeff Long is now the AD at Arkansas, used to be assistant AD at Michigan. Joe Parker. I believe he's the deputy AD at Texas Tech. He used to be in charge of development and athletics at Michigan as well. So the list is not short. It's a very strong list. You probably can't go wrong.
Let's look ahead to this Saturday. We've got Michigan State hosting Ohio State. How big is this? I saw some comments that gets the sense that both of them are like, yeah, this is great, but we really like beating Michigan.
They have a mutual enemy, don't they?
Yeah.
You know, the animosity between Michigan State and Ohio State never rises to the level that they both feel for Michigan, for different reasons perhaps in some ways. But I got to tell you, after the Michigan State game 2 weeks ago up in East Lansing, and of course I went to Michigan, and I'm used now to getting sympathy from Buckeye fans about the Wolverines. Now the Spartans are starting to feel bad, pity even, for the Wolverines. And that's something that I've not experienced in my lifetime.
Any predictions?
Dogfight and a low-scoring dogfight. Michigan State's defense is all that. Maybe not quite as good as last year's, but Ohio State's offense is not quite as good as last year's either. Their Heisman Trophy hopeful, Braxton Miller, at quarterback, was out in August before the season even started. They've got a backup in there, and he's doing quite well. So both these guys can coach. It'll be a slugfest, and whoever wins that game, almost everyone believes, me included, will win the Big Ten and get a real shot at one of the four playoff spots in January.
As a matter of fact, it seems that really Michigan State is the brightest spot for the Big Ten right now.
I would have to say that's probably true. They've got the best chance, I think, of being in that Final Four and probably the best chance of winning a game in that Final Four.
And then Michigan off to Northwestern.
Yep, and that's a one team is mediocre, the other team is schizophrenic.
So,
I don't know where that leaves you.
We'll leave it on that note. Michigan Radio sports commentator John Ubakin. Thanks, John.
Always a pleasure.
This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. A book may be small, but it's powerful. So imagine the potential impact of a small box filled with free books. Take a book, leave a book. That's the idea behind the Little Free Library movement. It was launched in 2009 in Madison, Wisconsin. And in just a few short years, this movement has spread to the point where today there are thousands and thousands of little free libraries all over the world. Well, now the Little Free Library movement is taking root in Detroit. We caught up with some kids at North Rosedale Park where a Little Free Library is going up.
Do you guys want to pick out a book? Do you want to pick out a book before we go? Oh, you do.
I'm Gwen Vaughn. I'm 10. I think it's going to be cool because then we don't have to drive like 10 minutes to our regular library. But I would like to find history books and Shakespeare books.
Hi, my name is Azalea and I'm 12 years old. I like reading fiction books and like books that have like a little thrill in it. I like scary books.
My favorite kind of book is probably adventure. Like, my favorite book right now is probably The Swiss Family Robinson, which is a really good book. My name is Ethan Yonke, and I am 11.
Let's hear from the organizer. Kim Kozlowski is the higher education reporter for the Detroit News. Good to have you with us on the program, Kim.
Well, thanks for having me here today.
When and why did you get the idea of putting little free libraries into Detroit neighborhoods?
Well, my husband and I put up our own little free library this past summer, and it just really took off. People came out of their houses, they talked with us, they rotated books, and it just created this sense of community unlike we had seen before. And we thought it would be a great idea to raise some money and build a bunch of them and put them throughout Detroit so others could enjoy that same sense of community, especially as the city is on the verge of a comeback.
You've been looking for donors, for books, for money. Who's coming through and with what?
We are looking for probably more money. And the reason why is because we did get someone who heard about the campaign, and he cleans out abandoned warehouses, and he found one abandoned by a book distributor and donated to us 148 crates of brand new title books. We still need children's books and children's book by diverse authors, but we're still searching for that as well as funding, because we have started a crowdfunding campaign on Indiegogo. It's in the last and final days. It's called Detroit Little Free Library, Capital of the World, and we're just trying to raise the funds so we can partner with two woodworkers who are creating little free libraries from wood from abandoned houses in Detroit.
That's great. And today's a big groundbreaking.
Yes. When the founder of the Little Free Library movement heard about this, He drove his trailer out from Wisconsin with 20 Little Free Libraries and decided to give them as a gift to the city to kind of get things started, get people excited. He arrived yesterday. We planted one at a church in Detroit. We planted one at an Airbnb in Detroit. We planted one at Write a House. We're planting one tomorrow at a social service agency in Highland Park that serves LGBT runaway youth. Tomorrow, the city is planting in 10 different diverse parks around the city. And today, we're planting in various historical neighborhoods, including North Rosedale Park, which is where we are currently.
What are your hopes for what the books in these little free libraries in Detroit could mean to children and adults?
Well, there are many studies that show that most people, their vocabulary stops developing after fourth grade. And you develop your vocabulary by reading after fourth grade, reading books, reading poetry, reading comics books, reading newspapers. And when your vocabulary expands, you not only, there are so many benefits. Your stress gets reduced, you sleep better, but there are also interpersonal benefits as well. You can connect better with people, you can communicate better. People perceive you differently, you perceive yourself differently, and ultimately it changes your lot in life. So ultimately, I hope that reading and books can have this reverberating effect on so many facets of our lives for individuals, communities, and neighborhoods.
Kim Kozlowski is the higher education reporter for the Detroit News, bringing the Little Free Library movement to Detroit. Anyone's welcome to put a Little Free Library in your community or neighborhood. You can find out more at littlefreelibrary.org. And the Detroit Little Free Library, as Kim mentioned, is raising money on Indiegogo to put 313 Little Free Libraries in the city of Detroit. The campaign runs till November 11th on Indiegogo, and we've got a link for that on the stateside page at michiganradio.org. Kim, thank you so much.
Well, thank you for having me.
Whenever you flip through a magazine like National Geographic and spot a stunning wildlife photo, take a moment and thank George Shiras. The Pennsylvania lawyer was one of the very first to capture wildlife on a camera, and he did it in the woods of Michigan's Upper Peninsula in the late 1800s, and that set him on a path to becoming one of America's leading conservationists. James McCommons is a professor at Northern Michigan University, where he teaches journalism and nature writing, and he brings us the story of George Shiras in the current issue of Michigan History magazine. So good to have you with us, James.
Thank you for having me.
So George was born in Pittsburgh in 1859. So how did he wind up coming to Michigan?
His grandfather was a fisherman, a fly fisherman, and his grandfather started to come to the Upper Peninsula before the Civil War to fish for speckled trout, which would be coaster brook trout. And he would come to Sault Ste. Marie and then take a boat along the Lake Superior shoreline, and eventually he became friends with some of the new pioneers at Marquette, which was Peter White, one of the founding fathers, and continued to come back and brought his son and then later brought his grandson, George III.
And they were fishing. Did they hunt? What kinds of activities did he begin to enjoy in the UP?
They were mostly fishermen. They did hunt. They would often get Native American guides from Marquette, and they would set off on boats and camp along the shoreline and fish and hunt.
But he transitioned from a hunting rifle to a camera, didn't he?
He did. He was a hunter. He was a hunter all of his life. He never gave up hunting. But when he was in his late 20s, early 30s, he began to experiment with photography while he was coming to the UP on summer vacations. And at that time, he was going to a place called Whitefish Lake, which is between Munising and Marquette. And the land and the lake was owned by Peter White. And George was experimenting with photography there.
And what kinds of developments did he come up with? Because, as you say, he is a seminal figure in the conservation movement and as a camera hunter.
Well, as a camera hunter, what he came up with was that he would put a large box camera into the front of a canoe in the, this would have been like about 1880s, and they would go around the lake at night shining a parabolic reflector at the deer. They were basically shining deer on the shore, and then they would slowly push their canoe in towards the deer. The deer would be sort of mesmerized and still by the light. And then he would stand up and fire off a chemical flash and take a picture of the deer. It took him 3 years to make this work before he got his first image.
Well, you have, in your article in Michigan History, you have a couple of these images, and there is an absolutely stunning one of the deer bounding away, the three of them at the one time. It's an incredible picture. I would have been thrilled to have been able to capture that, you know, on my camera today, and that he did that right after the Civil War is pretty stunning.
He did, and that was actually a different technique. What he was doing then was he was setting up tripwires for some of these cameras and setting them on the shore. The deer would trip the camera, and then it would take their picture, and then he started to set up two chemical flashes. So the first chemical flash would frighten the deer to be bounding like that, and then the second one would go off with along with the shutter and would capture the picture.
The camera trap.
So they had these, so they had these very kinetic motion, and that was one of the ways that he did it.
I am talking with James McCommons, whose story in Michigan History on George Shiras III, who has really become, as we maybe don't know the name, but a camera hunter and a conservationist who really pioneered wildlife photography. James, it seems George III had two distinct lives because he did continue. He was a Pennsylvania lawyer and a politician. He ultimately became a U.S. congressman. And then there's this photographer and lover of nature and wildlife in the U.P. Which do you think was more important to him?
I think they were both actually very important. His photography gave him a lot of notoriety as a naturalist, particularly when he took his pictures over to this new magazine in Washington, D.C., which was called National Geographic. National Geographic had not published any type of wildlife pictures up until that point, and in 1906, Gilbert Grosvenor, who was the new editor of the magazine, purchased 70 images from George and ran them in the magazine, which was a revelation for a lot of people, and really started National Geographic on its road to becoming this picture-oriented magazine. At the same time, he was a congressman and a progressive, part of the progressive conservation movement at that time. He was also a friend of Theodore Roosevelt's. And he introduced some important legislation while he was in Congress that was conservation-oriented, including something called the Shiras Bird Bill, which at that time failed in Congress, but later became the Migratory Bird Act about several years later. And after George left Congress, he wrote a lot of magazine articles and lobbied for the passage of that bill. The Migratory Bird Act is one of the most important early pieces of conservation legislation that America ever had.
And this was such a new concept in the late 19th, early 20th century, conservation. Imagine that.
It was. It was a new period, and it was a period of that many species had been disappearing around the country, including the buffalo, the passenger pigeon. There were not even that many white-tailed deer around at that time, probably only about 500,000 in the entire country. There was a real need to provide protection for animals and for habitat as well. So it was a time that people were looking on what we can do to save these animals because they are going to disappear or already had.
He died in, 1942?
He did.
And the Upper Peninsula at that time sure was a far cry from that area he first saw as an 11-year-old boy, wasn't it?
Yes, he really witnessed the Upper Peninsula as virgin country when he first came here, and then, you know, saw the establishment of railroads, dirt roads, eventually highways. At one time, they had to walk to their camp, which was 20 miles away from Marquette. By the end of it, they were able to drive their car out to their camp. So, yes, he was a man of his times in a sense that he felt civilization needed to move forward. But at the same time, he did witness from a local standpoint, a lot of devastation, particularly with the forest.
From our perspective now, as we talk in 2014, what do you think the name of George Shiras means in the world of conservation and wildlife photography?
I think in wildlife photography, because of these some of these iconic images that did appear in National Geographic, he's known as one of the pioneers of wildlife photography. I think he doesn't get as much credit for that Shriver's bird bill and really working out the legalistic framework for how legislation could happen that would protect birds as they moved from state to state. Up until this time, birds, including songbirds, could be shot at almost any time as they were migrating. And the Migratory Bird Bill allowed the federal government to take jurisdiction over these birds so they were protected when they were from moving from state to state. And by 1913, it really became a sort of a mainstream idea that, again, the loss of wildlife at that point was so devastating and so evident to many people that the bill passed. And I think that's a big part of his legacy.
Do you think is he remembered and appreciated, or has he been somewhat forgotten, and that's why you're kind of on this mission, you're writing a book about George III? Is he forgotten unfairly?
Well, he's forgotten, I guess, partly because the kind of photography that he was doing with these chemical flashes and tripwires and those kind of things really went out of style by the 1920s. We had longer lenses, faster film, wildlife photography moved ahead. But it's funny because now a lot of people use these trail cameras. Many hunters use those to photograph their deer. You know, these are cameras that you strap onto trees, and the animals trip a laser beam, and then you can take a picture of them. A lot of hunters and sportsmen are using those things now, and biologists are using them as well around the world to capture photography of animals that are elusive. And it's really the camera trap. It's the kind of device that George Shiras invented 100 years ago. So in many ways, his photography and that method is coming back.
James McCommons is a professor at Northern Michigan University. He is, as we mentioned, writing a book about George Shiras III, and his story about George III can be found in the current issue of Michigan History Magazine, and you have to check that out to see these fabulous photographs. I love the beaver gnawing the tree. Just a wonderful, yeah. Wonderful shot that he took.
It was amazing to me that how long it would take him to take these pictures. He would spend weeks going around the shore of the lake and very patiently waiting to take these photographs. And so they're really remarkable in a sense how well done they are, but the amount of effort that they took at that time.
James, thanks so much for speaking with us today.
Thank you.
Support for arts and culture coverage on Stateside comes in part from the Michigan Council for Arts and Cultural Affairs and the National Endowment for the Arts. This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Zoe Clark and Rick Pluta, our It's Just Politics team, are here now. Welcome back, you two.
Hey, Cindy.
Hello.
So the day before the election, you were with us. Your list of five things to watch on election day. So now the dust is settled. Let's look at the results, see how you did.
Indeed. Let's take a look at one of the first things we were watching in election 2014, and that was how well Governor Snyder would do in Detroit.
And what we saw was that in terms actually of the percentage of the vote, the governor actually did do a little better in Detroit than he did 4 years ago. 6.8% of the vote this year versus 5.3% 4 years ago. Now, he was never going to compete really per se in the city, but we were curious because the Detroit takeover and the bankruptcy, they just loom so big in Snyder's first term record. And so this election, both statewide and the city, in part was in fact a referendum on his handling of Detroit. So you know, what we've seen is that the governor really did not seem to pay a political price among voters in the city. But we really don't know how much of that percentage is actually an endorsement of Snyder versus the fall off that we saw in Democratic voting. Also, Snyder did get more actual votes, 11,000. 8,252 on Tuesday on official results versus 9,389 in 2010, which would be a net gain of 1,863 votes. And we'll also point out that Mark Schauer did win in Detroit, obviously, but got fewer actual votes than Virge Bernero got in 2010.
Exactly. Number two on our list, Cindy, was how is turnout? And turnout, especially Democratic turnout, it was down, way down. And Democrats bet the farm on boosting turnout and lost big. So let's turn to Kai Rizdahl, as we often do.
But first, let's do the numbers.
Okay, Rick, let's break down the numbers.
Well,
thanks, Kai.
Less than half of the folks who could vote in Michigan actually did. Turnout was 41.6% compared with the last midterm election, 2010, 4 years ago, when it was 42.9%. So the whole GOTV, get out the vote, finding 200,000 of the 900,000 Democratic voters who sat it out in 2010, that didn't work. Voters stayed home. But Zoe, what about absentee voting?
Absentee voting was up, though, in fact. But that might simply be because we're seeing more voters go absentee in every election cycle, right? It's easier. Cindy, you voted absentee this year.
More baby boomers, when you top 60 and realize you don't have to stand in line and you can have an absentee ballot, I think we'll see more people doing that.
But overall, I think just sort of the biggest indication about turnout, this fact, which is so sad, you have to go back 24 years to 1990 to find a lower turnout in Michigan. Insert sad panda music. Wah, wah, wah.
Wah, wah, wah.
So number three, we talked on Monday about the May Day PAC and how this PAC was going to try to shift things, change things for incumbent Republican Congressman Fred Upton in Michigan's 6th congressional district.
And the question was, why on earth did this campaign finance reform group, that's what the May Day PAC is, it's a largely crowdfunded organization that's looking to push campaign finance reform. Why did they target Congressman Fred Upton, who seemed to be safe? What did they see that the rest of us didn't?
$2 million, we should note, they threw into this race.
Wow.
Yeah, yeah. And as it turns out, what did they see?
Nothing.
Nada. Upton actually, with all of that money thrown at him, actually did a little better this year than he did in 2012. 55.8% this year compared to 54.6% 2 years ago. And this is actually kind of a strange little story. So apparently the May Day PAC was casting about for something like a test case somewhere where they could see if they could move the needle. But what they needed was a race where there weren't other independent groups playing so that they could, well, you know, in part at least measure the results. So the 6th congressional district had a seemingly safe Republican, but he chairs a committee, a big committee, one of the biggest, Energy and Commerce. It has purview over a wide range of special interests, and they will often express their loyalty, interest in the terms of campaign contributions. So there's a narrative, and here's the other part. On paper, at least, the 6th district, it's kind of a 50-50 district. Barack Obama won it in 2008. Mitt Romney won it barely in 2010. And Fred Upton always wins by running above the party baseline, appealing to independents to make it over the goal line. So basically what happened in 2010 was that happened again, and Fred Upton easily won re-election. And again, a big part of that may be that just with the super depressed turnout, maybe the May Day PAC just picked the wrong year.
Indeed. Okay, so let's go to number four on this list. And I don't even know if we really need to jump into it very much. The question was, could incumbent Congressman Kerry Bentivoglio be a spoiler in the 11th Congressional District running as a write-in? The answer is no.
No.
Not even close.
Flat no.
Republican Dave Trott beat Democrat Bobby McKenzie by almost 39,000 votes. That was 56% to 41%. This is a
And McKenzie ran this really ferocious campaign, trying to
But we're going against me saying we're not even going to talk about this one because it's just so not even worth it.
It turned into the big non-story.
This is simply a safe Republican seat. Let's go on to number five.
It is simply a safe Republican seat.
Number
exactly.
five on the list. And that was, can Democrats pick up enough seats to take the state house? The answer, no. In fact, they lost seats. The new House Republican majority will now be 63 to the Democrats, 47.
47. And we should say that is approaching super majority status. In fact, a 63 member majority in some ways it's not even a gift. It's so big that all of the attendant factions within a caucus of that size that can be very difficult to manage. Republican leaders, Governor Snyder, they may have a double-edged sword on their
hands. Careful
hands.
What you wish for.
Mm-hmm, that's true. But again, it just came down to that turnout. Voters, especially Democrats, did not get out. And some of those races, they were. Despite that, they were quite close. And what that shows is redistricting matters. In some cases, certainly, the way those districts were drawn by the Republican legislature had to make a difference. Regardless, we have a lot of depressed Democrats out there who just had a bad year. So we brought along a song.
This little song for them.
There's got to be a morning after if we can hold on.
And to remind them that there are only 733 days until election 2016.
Now stop. Oh. That is just so wrong, you two. You need to go detox, both of you, a little while at least, please. That's just sick. Rick Pluta and Zoe Clark, Michigan Radio's co-hosts of It's Just Politics, as always, thank you, you two.
Thank you so much, Steve.
Pleasure.
Well, both parties spent a huge amount of money in Michigan leading up to Election Day. But when you look at it, not much has changed. We continue to have a Republican governor, secretary of state, and attorney general. The GOP continues to control the state house and state senate, and Michigan will continue to send Democrats to the U.S. Senate. So was all that money spent worth it? And where exactly did it come from? Rich Robinson directs the Michigan Campaign Finance Network. Welcome back to Stateside, Rich.
To be with you.
Here we are 2 days post-election day, and it does appear it's pretty close to the status quo.
Well, it does, but we've been through a lot, and a lot of persons and interest groups have invested a lot of money over the course of the campaign. My assumption is always that they don't do that for selfless reasons, that they're looking for some sort of consideration, whether it's a policy, a contract, whatever it might be. So as much as we can know about where the money comes from, I think it serves us well in the capacity of oversight of government.
Do we know how much money was spent in this 2014 campaign to basically not see a whole lot of change?
Well, we've got very good ideas in a lot of areas. There are certain things on the edges that probably never will be known. But, for example, we can say with very good authority that it was about $55 million spent in our U.S. Senate campaign. Most of that money, $35 million of that $55 million, was spent by independent groups. In some cases, those were PACs or super PACs that disclose who their donors are. In other cases, they were political nonprofit corporations who don't disclose their donor. That should be a caution flag at the very least, or a red flag for citizens. In the gubernatorial campaign, the spending comes out roughly to $45 million. These things will all be refined in the next few days. In that case, again, the candidates were good for about $21 million, or at least when we last heard from them. That'll be a number that'll grow in the coming days. And the independent groups there were largely 527 committees that report to the IRS, but don't necessarily break out where the money came from that went to Michigan, how the money was spent in Michigan. And those 527 committees by name were the Republican Governors Association and the Democratic Governors Association.
But then we have the question about if we have any idea of how much of the so-called dark money was spent in all of these, you know, ads and things leading up to this election.
Well, we do. On the Republican side of the U.S. Senate race, it adds up to about $8.2 million, largely from elements of what I call the Koch machine, those nonprofit political corporations associated with David and Charles Koch, in particular Americans for Prosperity and the Freedom Partners Chamber of Commerce. The U.S. Chamber was good for $1 million, and Crossroads GPS, Karl Rove's nonprofit corporation, social welfare organization, was good for $750,000. On the Democratic side, the Environmental Defense Fund spent about $400,000. The Humane Society, $650,000. League of Conservation Voters, $1.3 million. Strong Michigan, which was a creature of the Credit Union League, $600,000, and the National Association of Realtors, $900,000. So all in all, about $4 million on that side. In the gubernatorial campaign, it was a lesser amount, truly dark money. The Michigan Republican Party spent about $2.5 million on ads that were not disclosed. And when they don't disclose the spending, they don't disclose the contributions that support it. Likewise, in the Attorney General campaign and in the state Supreme Court campaign, there was heavy dark money spending. In the Attorney General campaign, about 60% of what was spent was dark money, on television advertising at least. In the Supreme Court campaign, about 85% of what was spent on television advertising was dark money. So this should be particularly troublesome when you're talking about the highest court and your top law enforcement officer. In the case of the Supreme Court, it undermines the presumption of judicial impartiality. Was the spending from someone who has a high-stakes appeal in the pipeline coming to the court? Can the court be impartial in judgment of a major supporter? As regards the Attorney General, what does he assume his role as the people's lawyer is? And if anyone needs illustrations of how this jurisdiction can go badly wrong, there was a story in the New York Times last week about how lobbying, campaign support, and so forth is warping the mission of attorneys general across the country, Republican and Democratic alike.
Rich, we haven't seen voter turnout this low for decades in Michigan. Do you think the increase of this dark money and voters feeling like money's what's talking and they don't really have a lot of power in a simple vote, is that lowering turnout and tamping down people's yearning to get to the polls and make their voices heard?
Well, I don't think that there's any question whatever that people feel diminished in the process, that if money represents political speech, then most of the speech belongs to a very small handful of individuals and interest groups. At some point, I think that is meant to engender a sense of hopelessness, helplessness, that does tamp down voter turnout. And I think that that's a dangerous element encroaching on our democracy.
As we mentioned, so little changed in Michigan out of this election, politically speaking. But we can certainly guess that will not deter millions and millions and millions of dollars being spent in 2016, right?
Oh, I think that's absolutely certain. There's been a real momentum to the trajectory of all the outside spending, all the dark money spending. You know, it was my belief very early on that Terry Land was not a very viable candidate for the U.S. Senate, yet millions were spent. It seemed to me as an experiment to see if you could take someone and turn them viable just by spending money in their name or on their behalf. And you can bet that there are individuals who have way more money than they need for their own personal well-being, in many cases more dollars than cents, I think, and they'll spend money on absolutely fruitless efforts, but they have so much money and they just like to play.
Rich Robinson directs the Michigan Campaign Finance Network. Always good to talk with you, Rich. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Cindy.
Support for the next idea on Stateside comes from Michigan Economic Development Corporation, committed to marketing Michigan to drive job growth and investment in our communities. MichiganBusiness.org.
Today's Stateside was directed by Allie Billings. Our executive producer is Zoe Clark, and our engineer today was Bob Scon. Contributors are Mike Blank, Zach Dieterman, Emily Fox, Haley Hirschman, Mercedes Mejia, Annie Norris, and Katrina Schaefer. This program is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you so much for listening.